Coming up, I have a guest who's doing the book recommendation, and this person is the only one that Justine said she'll allow to do the show. In addition, I have Garrick Jones, and he's going to be discussing men's lives, and especially gay men's lives, after traumatic events. I'm Brad Shreve, and you're listening to Queer Writers of Crime, featuring LGBTQ authors of mystery, suspense, and thriller novels. So last week, I told y'all that Justine has never let me down because she's never missed a recording session. That still holds true. She's not here today, but this was planned far in advance. She did say, since I won't be there, there is only one person I trust to fill in for me. And basically, if this person did not fill in for her, it would be an interview-only show today. But he is here. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Brad. Thank you for having me. And thanks to Justine for that, man.
Yeah, she's a fan. For those that don't know, that there may be one or two of you out there that never heard of Gregory Ashe. He has written more books than the number of years he's been on the planet.
That might actually be true. I didn't think about that.
It may be true. And what pisses me off is they're all good.
Thank you, Brad.
That is just wrong.
Oh, that was so nice of you. Thank you.
And there's a long list, but probably I'm going to guess what you're most known for is the Borealis Investigations. You have Hazard and Somerset series. Mm-hmm. And you also have Hazard and Somerset, A Union of Swords. Now, Hazard and Somerset are an investigative team, right?
They are, yeah.
Okay. How is Hazard and Somerset, A Union of Swords, different than the original
series? Well, yeah, no, that's a great question. And I have tried to find a good, like, succinct way of explaining it. So one person recommended just describing it as, like, season two. So if you think of the first set as season one, you know, there's these six mysteries, and then there's kind of a break. We move forward in time. There's some character changes that I don't want to give away. And then season two starts, like, you know, you might pick up season two of Luther or, you know, another TV show. And so... so they're same guys, just some changes. They've moved forward, and they're kind of at a different place in life.
So, like, they were shuffled to a new network and made some changes.
Yes, yeah, and those execs wanted some changes, exactly.
And in addition to those, he and C.S. Poe have been working together on a new series. Are there two of them now?
We have two of the books out, yes.
Yes, Auden and O'Callaghan series. Yeah. And are we expecting more?
Yeah, in fact, Carol and I are working on book three right now. So hopefully, you know, it's a little bit, that's always a side project, but hopefully this year that'll be out. So,
okay, they've been working on that. Your first one was late last year, mm-hmm. and both of their fans have been absolutely giddy about the whole deal.
They've been real supportive. Yeah. They've been really supportive. Yeah.
And the other thing I want to say is Gregory is very sensitive.
Oh.
A few months ago, some of you may remember that on the podcast, I told Justine she was fired. Greg actually thought I was serious and could not believe I would do such a horrible thing.
I was so upset with you, Brad. I was like, he's doing this to her. And I thought it was live. Of course it wasn't. But at the time, I was like so shocked. Yeah.
I'm not that evil. I tend to be evil at times.
Afterwards, I laughed really hard. But at the time, I was like, oh, my gosh. Yeah, you got me with that one. And I think you got Justine. I don't think she knew what was going on.
No, she seemed a bit flabbergasted.
Yeah, so, that was great.
So he's sensitive and gullible.
Terrible qualities in a detective. Yeah, I would not make a very good detective.
Yeah, it's a good thing you write them rather than do it.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
So Greg is filling in for Justine to do the book recommendation this week. And Greg, what do we have?
Well, yeah, thank you again for letting me come do this. And thank you to Justine for, you know, being making that invitation happen. So I have for you the first book in Josh Lanyon's Secrets and Scrabble, and it's called Murder at Pirate's Cove. So, and I know that you, the show for the most part is own voices, but we talked about this title in advance because I know some of your listeners will probably wonder, you know, about picking this title. And I just wanted, one of the reasons that I wanted to bring this up is because I think it's such an interesting example of a genre that we don't have, like a subgenre that we don't have a lot of examples of in gay mystery, and that is the cozy mystery. Are you much of a cozy reader, Brad? Do you read a lot of those?
I have just started reading cozies.
And maybe you can fill me in if there are some that I don't know about, because I'm sure there are. I don't know in the gay mystery realm, but this is the first one, I think, in the gay mystery genre that I have read. And it's really a lot of fun. So for people who are listening who don't know, cozy mystery refers to like this subgenre of mystery that is supposed to be somewhat as feel good as like a story about someone getting murdered can be, right? Like that it's like usually it's mostly like maybe some quirky characters, a mostly likable protagonist. They're usually like settings where people want to go. So they're like quaint English villages or like beachside towns. And so it's like things like that that people might, you know, where people might want to spend some time as kind of a getaway. And another big deal, and this is why I think it's so interesting to see kind of this subgenre emerging in gay mystery, is that they typically have no on the page sex or violence or swearing. And I know that you and Justine have talked at different points about kind of the proportion of sex and romance in a gay mystery book, right? Like, I mean, am I right? That's come up a few times and you guys have...
Yeah, I probably bring it up a lot more than I should. But...
Well, it's an important topic. I mean, like, yeah.
Yeah. And sometimes it's very fascinating. Michael Nava said it really well. He said, when it comes to sex, who a person has sex with and how they have sex can tell you a lot about their character.
Mm-hmm.
So he has no problem putting in his novels because that makes sense. And having read seven of his books, I agree with him.
Yeah.
I tend to frown upon if it's just thrown in for the sake of being thrown in. So not everybody has to, do a fade to black. You can have some pretty graphic sex and some really hot, naughty stuff. Well, not naughty, but...
Sometimes.
Yeah. You know, as long as it's still a mystery, it has to be clear cut. No matter what else, it's a mystery. So erotica is fine, romance is fine, but it has to be a mystery.
Yeah, and I know that is one of the lines that gets blurred the most frequently in this genre. And I know I'm probably just inviting a lot of comments, but I mean the idea that there are a lot of books that market themselves or that put themselves on the list of gay mystery for Amazon, right? But are really much more erotica or romance. And so what I think this was to me such an interesting, this book is really fun for a lot of reasons. And I'll talk more about the plot in a moment. But one of the things that I think makes this book really interesting for our genre is the question of like, well, will a good number of those readers who are reading for the relationship side of a story, will they still read a book that doesn't have sex in it? And the answer seems to be yes. Like, she's done very well with this series. It's been very successful. And on top, and I think what makes it successful is that it has an appealing gay protagonist who solves an interesting mystery. And then it fulfills these conventions of the cozy mystery. So that was my reason for choosing this. And now let me tell you a little bit about the book and the plot, and then we can talk about it. Yeah, do you want to? Yeah.
I want to say one more thing about that.
Yeah.
It used to be mystery readers were mystery readers and romance readers were romance readers as a rule. And what I like to say when somebody asks to be a guest on the show is I'm totally fine with a mystery that has romance in it, but not fine with a romance that has mystery in it. And like you said, we're starting to see a crossover, which I think is great because I tell people you can love the Hallmark Channel, but then you can turn to the Sci-Fi Channel and enjoy that as well. And you don't expect them to be the same thing.
Right.
And unfortunately, in books, that wasn't always true. Now I kind of feel like people are getting it.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, that quote that you gave from Michael Nava, and I agree, I love his stuff, I mean, is, I think, really valuable. And certainly not every book about a gay protagonist who is a detective needs to delve into their sex life, but it sure does tell you a lot about them, you know? And I mean, I think that it can, when it's intentional and purposeful, like, that's a really powerful tool in writing. And so, yeah. So this book, okay, is about Ellery Page. Ellery is to his own knowledge, you know, kind of by his own admission, a very, very attractive man who failed at being an actor. He's pretty upfront about his lack of acting chops, and he has a history where he had a friend who kind of wrote him parts in a series of teen horror movies. So in my mind, they're kind of like, what was that franchise called? Was it, not Scream, but like kind of I don't know, something like Scream or like one of those teen horror thrillers that had a bunch of sequels.
Oh, that God, there's dozens of them.
Yeah. So he's kind of like one of those real handsome guys who gets a part but can't act his way out of a paper bag. And when that franchise dries up, he's kind of at a loss. He has, his life has kind of come apart because his boyfriend cheated on him. And so when his great aunt dies, and she leaves him ownership of a house and a bookstore, a mystery bookstore, in a small town on the coast, he decides to leave New York, and he goes to the fictional town of Pirate's Cove to kind of start his life over. And the book opens, I mean, there's really no, like, this isn't a spoiler because it's the first chapter. The book opens with him finding a dead body in his bookstore. And so from that point on, Ellery is kind of in a race to prove that he did not kill this person, because he is slowly being framed for the person who was found murdered in his bookstore.
You didn't give any way. We typically expect a body to show up somewhere.
Yeah, that's right. Yes. it wouldn't be much of a murder mystery if that didn't happen. But it's a lot of fun. It has, as I was describing, those cozy elements. You know, it's like it's a small town. There's likable people. There's suspicious people. There's annoying people. You get kind of the fun of seeing someone who is really not part of that community get enmeshed in the secrets and the scandals that were all under the surface, but that for him as a newcomer were not really visible or present yet. And then meanwhile, there's other things that make this book fun. Like, there's, because it's Pirate's Cove, they're having Buccaneers Day. So people are wandering around and, you know, they're kind of Hollywood style pirate costumes, and Ellery's scrambling to keep this store afloat, his bookstore, because, you know, it's the slow season. They don't have a lot of tourists right now. The police chief who is investigating him is possibly bisexual. It's kind of left very ambiguous in this book, but they seem to have some sort of spark, whether it's just a friendship or something more. And so, like, there's a lot of elements that are really pleasurable about this book beyond the mystery. So, yeah. Anyway, I decided, I at Brad's recommendation, because I forgot, I looked at Justine's categories, her types of recommendation. I'm going to give this a glowing recommendation because I really just thought it was an excellent, polished, cozy mystery that was also a feel-good book. And so I really enjoyed it.
Sounds good. And actually, I haven't read that one, but I've read, what was her earliest ones? Aiden English?
Yeah, I was going to say, yes, those are her best known. And you had her on the show, I think, right?
Yes, and I really enjoyed that series. And did you say earlier that this is an Own Voices show?
Well, I said I thought it was. I wasn't sure what you had decided.
No, the guests have to identify as LGBT or Q.
Okay.
But they don't necessarily have to be Own Voices. We have a male guest coming up that wrote lesbian mysteries. I've had a couple people that wrote straight mysteries. So
is that the Lambda winner? I can't think of his name right now. He just won this year. That's not who he is.
No, I'm drawing a blank on that one.
No, that's okay. No, I was just curious. Okay, well, thank you for reminding me, because I know there was discussion about it, and I just blanked when I started talking, so I couldn't remember.
And Justine, I do let her slide when it comes to the reviews.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's a lot out there. Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah. Well, it's a great book. I hope people will give it a try. It's really a fun start to a great series.
Well, thank you. And I really want to thank you for being a guest today. I'm glad.
Thanks for having me. This was so fun.
I'm glad Justine insisted that it be you on the show. It was really funny. I mean, she's like, it has to be Greg.
Well, she has been so supportive of me just from the very beginning. She's always been so kind and encouraging. So, yeah. Thank you, Justine, awesome. If you're listening to this one.
All right. Well, I have a fine bloke, Garrick Jones, coming up in just a minute.
Oh, fun.
We had a good time.
You've had Garrick on a couple times, right?
I think this was the third time.
You guys always have great conversations.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
All right, well, hang on, and Garrick is coming right up.
Here we go.
If you enjoy Queer Writers of Crime, let others know by leaving a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you hear our show. Okay, this is Brad, and before I get to my interview with Garrick, I need to explain something. When I recorded the interview, I had some problems. Garrick's track came out just fine. He sounds good. My track, however, most of it I sounded like one of the chipmunks. And while I thought you may think that's funny for all of about 30 seconds, I think that's probably when the funny would have ended. Fortunately, the transcription service I had did pick up everything I said. So there are parts where it's going to sound like I'm nowhere near Garrick and I am reading from a script and he is answering the questions. That is exactly what I was doing. We couldn't get together to find a good time to redo the interview, and it was just too good of an interview for me not to release it. I don't think it's nearly as bad as I'm making it sound. So here we go. Well, my good friend Garrick.
G'day there, Brad.
It's good to have you back. Is this the second or third time?
I think this is our third time.
It's always a pleasure to have you on. I want to ask something right off the bat. Most of your novels are written in the past. In fact, all of them are, unless I'm missing a couple. Are there any contemporary ones?
Only one, Wheelchair, is the only contemporary one, which is written probably in 2016, I think I based it, so not exactly contemporary, but that's close. Everything else is pre-1960.
And the Clyde Smith novels take place in the mid-1950s. Most recent is The Gilded Madonna. What is it about past eras that interests you?
It's less so much about the past eras, but the familiarity with that particular period, that immediate post-war area where I grew up. And there's so much unspoken about it, especially in terms of the role of men in society, that I felt was worth really exploring. In the First World War, you know, men came back from the war and they literally just didn't talk about it. Nothing happened. And more or less the same thing happened in the Second World War, but somehow men were more aware of the trauma they'd been through. So I grew up surrounded by guys, what I call ruined men who'd not been able to escape their experiences, and yet they were trying to cope. And I think the main difference was that after the Second World War, organizations set up to support social organizations for returned servicemen. So these guys got together and they were able to talk a bit about their war experiences, so they were slightly closer to the surface. And every single male in my family when I was growing up had served either in the First World War or the Second or in both or in Korea. So it was the type of explore that difficulty of what it was like trying to be a man that wasn't like the head of the family on Father Knows Best or Leave It to Beaver, but, you know, that sort of archetypal father with kids and happy wife and everything, but men who really struggled. And it's also a very interesting period of history, that 1950s, extraordinary change, you know, when everything, the new modern era where everything old was out and we had to get new things, and there was consumerism was born, and then the fight against communism, Reds Under the Beds. It's a very interesting period.
Yeah, and I will say you really have captured that well. You've taken me there to understand what men were going through during that era, when during a time period where they faced horrific things, and weren't allowed to talk about it, weren't allowed to share their feelings about it. It was a very sad period in that sense.
Oh, it was terrible. I never found out exactly what some of my male relatives went through until more or less they were on their deathbeds, you know, men in their 80s, and they eventually would start to share a bit of it. It was just devastating. And to think that when I was a kid and they were being really nice to me and trying to, you know, be adult with me, they were going through this terrible crisis inside, very difficult to cope with. And that, they didn't have the avenues to express themselves. And of course, society is quite different. People judged. If you were seen to be weak, then you were not a true man, basically, in that time.
Yeah, my dad served in World War II, but he didn't really, a lot of it was spent in Oklahoma in officer training. And then when he was assigned to a naval ship, it was a repair ship, and I don't think they saw much action at all. However, I know his growing up, his childhood was far from ideal. But I don't know, I only know a little bit, because like most men at that time, he would not talk about it. He would just say, you know, I had problems when I was a kid, and I don't have any issues as a result of it. I just deal with it. Well, you know what? He wasn't really dealing with it all that well.
No, that's true. A lot of men talk about that. They say, I'm dealing with it, but it's patently obviously that they're not dealing with it, or they weren't. You know, they had no avenue. That at least they had their friends. We have this particular type of male bonding in Australia, which we call mateship, where men become very, very close buddies, I suppose, more than just sitting down and watching the game together like we see on American TV, you know, with popcorn and beer, but, you know, really, really very close friends. And often those very close friends were men with whom they fought during the war. So the shared experience is carried over into civilian lives. I have an American friend that I interviewed years ago who served in the Second World War, and he didn't make contact with any of his buddies when he came home, and he carried a lot of that grief with him right throughout his life, not being able to share it, relive it. I think about my great uncle, never spoke about his war experiences until he was singled out for a special honour by the War Museum in Australia, and I had no idea that he had been at Gallipoli, the famous, you know, where Anzac had been born. He'd been in the charge of Beersheba after that, had a nervous breakdown. So they sent him off to England to recover. And when he recovered, they trained him as a pilot. So he ended up doing dogfights over the German territory in 1918. We had no idea about that, any of that, until almost he was dead. He kept that all to himself. Extraordinary man. And then he fought in the Second World War as well.
And that's not uncommon to hear kids learning sometimes after their parents died to find out what their father went through during a particular war.
And of course, the men hold it inside to try and protect their family. Mm-hmm. And yet it's the thing that the families really want to know because they want to be able to help them.
Exactly.
It's that whole thing of being a bloke or a man or a mate or whatever you want to call them, that we're supposed to be strong and, you know, figureheads. And that's not who we really are. We're just people like anyone.
I know you're here to talk about the Gilded Madonna, and we're definitely going to talk about it, but The Boys of Ballarue, was that your first novel?
That was the first published novel, yes.
Okay, yeah, because I knew it was the first one I had read, and I will say you captured that, what we're talking about exactly here, beautifully. And I just want to say, well done. I've told you before how much I enjoyed that novel. And I highly recommend it if anybody that's interested in what we're discussing.
It's still getting a huge amount of feedback, actually. I just had a letter this morning by email from a reader in England who wrote to me and said how much they were enjoying it. So it's done very well. I'm very pleased. But I want, in that particular book, I wanted to take those six decades in Australia of men at war, from the Great War right through the Vietnam War, and to explain that over those 60 years, there wasn't really a period where no one didn't have a relative or lived through a period where there wasn't war.
Right.
You know, there was, what, you know, 20 years between the end of the First World War, the beginning of the Second, and the Second World War straight after that was the Korean War. A few years after that was Vietnam. So there was the whole century was engulfed by global conflicts. And I wanted to talk about how specifically gay men changed over those period of 60 years, how their roles changed and how they related to society. Gay wasn't invented in you know, rainbow marches in, or Stonewall in the 1960s. It's always been around.
Yeah, my dad said that he had a bunkmate that one day the MPs came in and escorted him away. And it's because they found out he was gay or whatever term they used at that time. And he was never seen again. My dad had no idea whatever happened to him. And that was sadly too common.
It's very interesting, though. When I was doing my research for my World War II books, I discovered that none of the Commonwealth countries, that's including the United Kingdom, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, ever questioned people enlisted about their sexuality. It wasn't an issue. It was only really the USA that started to ask people about their sexuality.
There's a good movie I want to tell you about that, but I probably should do your introduction so people know who the hell I'm talking to.
Okay.
The Outback to the Opera, after a 30-year career as a professional opera singer, performing as a soloist in opera houses and in concert halls all over the world, Garrick Jones took up a position as lecturer in music in Australia in 1999 at the Central Queensland Conservatorium of Music, which is now part of CQ University. Brought up in Australia between the bush and the beaches of the eastern suburbs, he retired in 2015 and now lives in the tropics, writing, gardening, and finally finding time to enjoy life and to reestablish a connection with who he is after a very busy career on the stage and as an academic. And regarding that, I will say you send periodically pictures of your garden, and you do seem to enjoy living in the tropics.
I do.
There is a movie, and I hope before we're done, I can remember the name because I would highly recommend it to everybody. But it talks about the changes that happened in the military, in the U.S. military, regarding gay men. And at the beginning of the war, they were actually welcome. They were given jobs like working in the stores or doing performances. But then all of a sudden, I don't know if it was the president or
who. Well, I can tell you how that happened.
Okay.
There was a Boston psychiatrist called Stack Sullivan, and he wrote a recommendation about recruitment. There had been so much that they'd lost more fighting men in the First World War due to shell shock, due to nervous disposition they had to any other being wounded. When they knew they were coming into the war, they wanted to try and find out who the ideal type of candidate was. So he wrote a paper on ideal characteristics of candidates and also how to identify pathologies of people who might be sensitive or to succumb to, shell shock, that type of nervous disposition. And in his recommendation, he wrote, however, people of color and people with different sexual identities should not be barred from joining up. Well, now, as that went up the chain of command, what actually happens, people saw the thing about black people. They went, ding, this is a warning bell. And so gay men got hooked into the same category. And then they started to ask questions. I think it was 1942. They started asking questions about sexuality. There's a couple of really good books. I can't remember the title. They're in my bookshelf in the other room, about the history of gay American men during the Second World War. Very well worth reading. Fighting Proud, that's what one of them's called. Yeah. Yep. No, that's wrong. Wrong book. Sorry.
I want to get to Clyde, because I really like Clyde Smith. He was the protagonist in The Cricketer's Arms, and he's also the protagonist in your latest book, The Gilded Madonna. I want to get right to it. What kind of man is Clyde Smith?
Clyde Smith is one of those ruined men that I told you about, whose history was that he enlisted in 1939 and went off with the 9th to fight in North Africa, and he was working in a covert section, training in a covert section to try and rescue friendly troops and stuff like that. And he got sent to an assignment to rescue a man who was a cousin of the King of Italy, and gets captured and spends 3 years in a prisoner of war camp, first under the Italians and then under the Germans at the end. So he's, and then after the war, he fights with the partisans, towards the end of the year, and then finally comes back to Australia and joins the police force. And he's really haunted by his treatment in the prisoner of war camp and his experiences during the war, and is really quite unable to cope with what went on in the background. So he's a very fragmented man. He's a bit torch. He's a bit gruff. He covers his feelings by being hard, but there's a real soft spot about it. He's very kind and giving to people who deserve it. He has close friendships, but he's never able to really establish a relationship until he meets Harry in the first book.
In the first book, Clyde's life was complicated, and it's complicated in the second book as well. In the first book, it seemed like it dealt a lot more with the complications with his love life and his relationships and sexuality. Like I said, he's still complicated, but he seems somewhat more settled when the book opens. Love Harry in his life, and the others that were involved with him in the first book seem to have moved on. What led you to make these changes?
Well, I thought the thing was that, you know what it's like when you fall in love for the first time in your life, it's quite different from that feeling of infatuation or thinking that you have been in love about when you're younger. You know, you go through maybe meeting people and you think you're really in love with them. But when it actually happens, it does change everything. It puts everything in perspective. And Clyde has been stuffed around so badly by his long-term lover, Sam Telford, is another policeman who's never wanted to commit. When he finally meets Harry, he just finds this thing so, such an upheaval, such a different thing of his life, he doesn't want to do anything to jeopardize it. So he maintains friendships with these other people who have been, they've been friends all along. They've never been just, you know, just sexual encounters. They've been friends, and he maintains the friendships, but he becomes really devoted and focused on this new thing, which is very new to him, that he values.
Having talked with men that were Clyde's age in the 50s, it seems like there were two types of relationships. One were hookups, which they feared, as well as far as I was told, out of fear that, I don't know if it's true in Australia, but in the United States, you never knew if you got caught, who would turn you in. So there was that risk factor. And then there's the other route. There were the types like Harry, his friendship sometimes do. It hits a very sad period in many ways.
Yeah, it was. But things were quite a little bit different in Australia because we didn't have the McCarthyism thing in Australia as badly as you did in the US. So the whole entrapment thing didn't really start until the mid-50s, and then it got pretty well slapped down because there are a couple of cases where policemen try to fit up gay men in public places, and then judges actually found evidence that the policeman could not have possibly seen what was going on. And because our law is run by precedent, so if a law is made by a judge and says that, for example, there was a particular case, I think it was 1953 or 54, I haven't got my notes with me about that, where a judge ruled that no longer could a sole policeman provide evidence of sexual misconduct. There had to be a couple of witnesses. And that became a law after that because it had been a precedent created in court. So things were a lot, there was a lot of entrapment that went on after that, but it was a different type of society. What actually happened in Australia, that there were sort of networks of friends, and that instead of going to parks and places to meet other guys, you met people socially through friends of friends of friends. And I wrote a blog about it called The Circle of Friends, which is basically how it worked in the 1950s, that men had a lot of acquaintances, and then their acquaintances, that's how they met their sexual partners. And if they weren't monogamous, if they were men who weren't in a position to want to, it was quite difficult for men to live together in the 1950s, unless they were related. But to have long-term relationships, they lived in separate houses, but often they just had pals with whom they slept and friends. I'm sure that still goes on now.
Yeah, actually, I think it does. And, you know, what we see in male-male romance now, isn't usually what happens. I think more often than not is two guys will hook up and have a good time, maybe a few times, and it turns into a relationship.
It doesn't work like that. We all know that. We all know that doesn't happen.
Yes, it does.
It does happen sometimes, but not all the time.
No. Yeah. It didn't happen with my first husband, with my current husband. Actually, he's the only husband I've had. We did meet online and started to get a really, really little frisky. And we just realized there's something more to this. I mean, it was instantaneously that we knew. So we kind of put it off, which is a very strange thing that gay men do. But my past two relationships, you know, it was like, let's get it on. And over time, a relationship developed. And that seemed to be the case in West Hollywood and in the Castro where I was during those times. It seemed to be the norm. Maybe it's not anymore. I don't know. But I doubt it's changed much.
I think that men's sexualities can revolve around having a sexual relationship that's not emotionally based. That's just a pure physical experience with no expectations. So it's like a hookup, a one night stand. Or there's like they get together a few times and maybe the sex isn't great and it turns into a friendship. Or they have a friendship that over time becomes more intimate than leads to sex. Or not all of us in the whole world have a relationship. There's a lot of men who go through life just being single and having – you know, male partners every so often. Not everybody wants a relationship, and sometimes people are just lucky to have one. There's a lot of single guys out there still looking.
Yes, there are. And it seems I'm focusing so much on sex in carrying the story, but in this novel and the past novel, it's almost critical for you to understand who Clyde is, and that's why I'm bringing it up quite a bit. In what other ways has Clyde changed since the Cricketer's Arms?
I think that the main change is actually being falling in love for the first time in his life, because it makes him emotionally very vulnerable. And a lot of the things that he's been pushing down during his life come bubbling up because of that. His feelings are far more present. There's a scene in the story where he goes to visit his mate Billy, who's the only remaining close friend he had fighting in North Africa, who's his solicitor, his lawyer as well. And he says, have you still got the name of that therapist you went to when you came back from the war? And he said, and Billy says, you know, don't tell me you're trying to finally bury those demons. And Clyde says, well, I just get feelings that are out of control. They come out of the blue and I can no longer really cope with them. And Billy says to him, that's because you're in love for the first time in your life. And these emotions are bubbling up without you being able to hide them down anymore. You're so much more emotionally sensitive. And of course, Clyde goes into therapy. Right at the end of the book, he starts having therapy. And book three, which I'm writing at the moment, starts off with him in a therapy session to sort of link them together.
Well, you're giving away some stuff here.
Oh, yeah. But it's no biggie in terms of the plot.
I know you well enough to know you write from the heart rather than writing to what the readers want. Given many people's expectations today, did you get any flack over Clyde being a somewhat promiscuous man in the first novel?
Well, it's really interesting that people say promiscuous because he grew up with one guy. They experimented together. That's how he discovered sexuality. He got together with Sam, with the guys in the army, which a lot happened to a lot of straight guys. You know, they hooked up with men because that was just what happened, like all men together, like in prisons, anywhere else where there's a male population. And then when he came back to work as a policeman, that's when he met Sam, and he had one other guy he saw in the time, and I suppose that's four men over the period of, you know, 15, 16 years. I don't think that's particularly promiscuous. I think you only call that promiscuous if you see it through the eyes of a romance reader, where men are not allowed to sleep with more than one person.
Based on my past, I certainly hope that's not considered promiscuous. And I'm sorry I used it for lack of a better term. But I do think others would see that as promiscuous, as you said. So tonight, I just wondered if you got any feedback.
I think that's just a misunderstanding in basic male sexuality. I mean, if guys were honest about the number of women that they slept with, I think that you'd probably find that there was, you would probably call that promiscuous if you're making the same comparison. And there's a lot of gay men who sleep with a whole lot more than that, than Clyde did. I mean, not too many years ago, there were bathhouses all over the place and pickup places. It wouldn't be unusual for a male to sleep with two or three partners a week, let alone a year. Men, straight men go to brothels. They might not call that as a sexual experience. They may sleep with five or six girls before they meet the right girl that they want to marry. It's a double standard. It makes me a bit annoyed, to be quite honest.
Very true. Now let's get to the novel. First of all, what is The Gilded Madonna?
The Gilded Madonna is a statue of Saint Sarah, and she's covered in gilt foil and sent to Clyde in the mail as a clue to one of the parts of the murder mystery, the serial killer mysteries. I won't say more about that because I don't want to give the game away, but it figures very strongly. It's a symbol throughout the book of how the case is solved, and it's linked. It's the linking. It's actually three different crimes that all actually come together, and they're all based on real-life events in Australia in the 1950s and 1960s, and they all come together as being part of one crime. So I don't want to give too much away, but it's a clue. This statue sent to Clyde.
Is there more to the story that you can tell us, or is that just going to give too much away?
Yeah, well, I can tell you a bit of the back about the background, the three different stories. I'll tell you about the original stories. That's one of the three main stories are all based on real life events. One is based on a man called William MacDonald, who was a serial murderer of gay men in the early 1960s. He was known as the mutilation murderer in Sydney because he used to slash men's throats in public toilets and cut off their private parts and take them home or stuff them in their mouths. And this one of these murders happened 100 yards from the school I was attending while I was at high school. So we were all evacuated when the body was found and everything. So that always stuck in my mind. The second case was about the kidnapping of a young boy exactly my own age in the 1950s after his parents had won the first big lottery in Australia. And he was kidnapped and held for ransom. And they later found his body had been killed 2 days after he'd been kidnapped, but they looked for him for months while the kidnapper kept on sending ransom demands. And the third case was the expose of the abuse of young boys in homes all over Australia during the 1950s, both physical and sexual abuse. So all of these three separate things are linked into one case, and it's about a murderer, a revenge murderer, a serial killer who wants Clyde to suffer. So there's a personal involvement in the whole thing.
Well, it certainly doesn't sound like three cheerful stories.
Well, not many crimes are cheerful, Brad.
These sound fascinating. Actually, I think you told me about the one across from your school before. I think you told me that in conversation once. So that was horrific, but the whole thing sounds gruesome and very enticing from a crime reader's perspective.
Yeah, well, I managed to backbuild the three stories into somebody who wants to not only humiliate Clyde, but to punish him. And this guy is, let's say, unstable and eventually wants to kill Clyde and have somebody witness the killing. I'll say no more.
Say no more. All right.
But most of the feedback I've had from it was people getting to the last 50 or so pages, trying to read it while they're in the bath or in bed, trying to get to the end to find out what happens.
Well, research. I've had many guests on who do a lot of research for their novels. Usually, it's people who write period pieces. For most of them, it's a passion. For you, it's a downright obsession. And I want to give you an example. You posted on Facebook one time I don't know where it was. It may have been on your personal account. You were trying to find a timetable on a train route between two small towns in Australia during the 1950s. Did you ever find it?
Yes, I did, and it stuffed my whole story up because I found out that the train line between the two towns had been disconnected about 15 years before the book was set. So this is a current book I'm working on, and so I couldn't use it. It's very interesting. When I was writing Australia's Son, I may have spoken to you about it, which is a story of the opera singer. It's about a murder mystery in a theatre in 1902. I found it easier to find the tram timetable between the centre of city and one of the outlying suburbs and the price of the ticket. I found that far more easier to find out than what was showing in the theatre at the time. So there are obsessives. There are people out here who obsess on things like timetables, especially when it comes to trams and trains and aircraft and ships. Yeah, look, I'm a real obsessor with – because I tell you – I had a review on my World War II book, which drove me crazy. I thought to myself, you know, please read the blurb that this is historical fiction. It's not a textbook on World War II, in which this reviewer wrote, this couldn't have happened on this date because somebody else, some X was somewhere else. And I thought, that's all you've got to write about, you know. Write about, it's historic, it's a fictional historical novel. It's not a textbook. They will write. People do write. If they find mistakes, they'll let you know. Don't worry. I'm sure you know.
Yes, I do know. But when I saw the question, I thought maybe I can help him out because it's the kind of thing I obsess over too. So I did some research and I did find that train line doesn't exist at all anymore. And I thought, well, who's going to know? And the answer is you would.
Well, not only I would know, but so many other people would know. I mean, it's really interesting. You and I have talked about this before. I get more emails than I get reviews. For some reason, people are loath to leave reviews, but I've got 90 emails in my inbox at the moment, not waiting to be answered, but have been answered, about people writing to me and saying, I've forgotten all about that. Thanks for reminding me. Yeah, I remember that happening. So I think that to make the story true, it's got to be true in your mind. Mm-hmm. That's why I never write about places I've never been to, haven't visited, or haven't lived in. I may have mentioned I read a book. I don't want to be careful here. A Canadian wrote a book about two guys hooking up on a sheep ranch in Australia. And the moment I saw sheep ranch, I nearly, you know, went, oh, my God, this is going to be awful. And it was. It had written by somebody who'd never been here, didn't know how we speak, didn't know how we talk, how we related to each other, certainly didn't know how a sheep station worked. So, yeah, I think you've got to be careful when you're writing stuff. I mean, if you don't care and you sell books, doesn't really matter, I don't suppose, but there's some of us who really do care about getting every I dotted and every T crossed.
You brought up something that interests me. You published 8 books, which to many people would not be a big deal. Actually, for some, that would not be very many. But the difference is all of yours are good. They're top quality. They're top quality. How are you able to do 8 books in 3 years and have them be such good novels?
Well, if I actually wrote 8 books in 3 years, I'd be very, very happy. But I started writing when I retired from work in 2013. So that's nearly 8 years ago. And I wrote maybe 4 or 5 books, and I had no idea if they were any good or not. And then I met a fellow writer in a forum who said he was really interested in reading historical fiction set during World War II. And I said, would you like to have a look at my book? I think it's, I don't know if it's any good or not. And he got back to me within 4 days. He said, this is amazing. You must do something with it. And I thought there was some ulterior motive behind it. I couldn't quite believe that this guy was so glowing. And in fact, he's quite a well-known published author himself. So I submitted it to a publishing house and they said, yes, please, very much. What else have you got? And that's when I started So I had a backlog. I had a backlog of 5 books. I normally write 2 books a year, I suppose. I go through extensive editing processes. To me, that the quality has got to be good of the way the words are used and how it looks on the page. So I have a developmental edit, and then a copy edit, and then a proofreading just to make sure it's all right. Sometimes the editors can be really tough, but in the end, they're always right. And I encourage anybody who's writing to make sure that they have a professional editor to get your book the best it possibly can be.
So the answer is you did not start 8 books in 3 years. It's been a longer period of time.
No.
That's to get there. Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
No, long. That's version 11 of that book.
Oh, my goodness.
So that's how many revisions it's gone through. Because you do find things. When you're writing, you go, you start reading, you go, oh, no, that couldn't possibly have happened because that bomber didn't exist at that airbase at that particular time. And you go, I've got to get that fixed up because somebody will write to you about it. Especially military. I mean, people are crazy about it.
It's interesting to me, and I'm not going to critique any because I haven't read all of everybody's books. Many of them I have not read. But some people, their editing process is only beta readers read their books, and then they publish it. And then you have somebody like yourself who has done 11 revisions. Well, probably somewhere in the middle, Garrick.
As you know, and I don't mind admitting this, I suffer from OCD as a result of PTSD. So I really, if it's not right, I'm one of those people who check the gas after I've left the house to make sure I've checked it up, I've turned it off. I sometimes drive back to the house, make sure I've closed the door. I have all my pens lined up in colors on my desk. I can show you. Everything is neatly color coordinated. I keep journals. I can't help it. That's just a psychological condition, and you learn to live with it. But it does make you a bit obsessive about writing, about getting things right. And I was brought up quite severely, but if it's not perfect, don't do it. That's a very, very hard standard to live up to in your whole life. But I do try, and I do want it to be right. And if people will point out a mistake, it makes me angry with myself. It doesn't make me angry with them.
And I hope you don't mind me saying so. As you know, Mitch, the main character in my novels, has PTSD. And I have interviewed men who have served in Afghanistan. But I've also bounced some things off of you to say, did I get this right? And you've been very helpful. So thank you for that. So we're kind of back to research, and I want to ask you one question. When you're researching, such as this timetable, at what point do you throw up your hands and just say, I'm just going to have to make it up?
I never do that. I change it. I change it to something that does work.
Let me give you an example, and it's some advice you gave me, and I'm going to somewhat contradict you here. The Hollywood sign has fallen apart and been rebuilt many times. It was originally a billboard and was only supposed to last 18 months. It was built and the H fell, and there was a story that up on the hill, the reason the H fell is that the caretaker got drunk and drove his truck down the hill, running over the H. Others have insisted, no, that's not true. It rotted. It fell down on its own. And I asked you, I said, I can't find the true answer. Where do I go? I can't find the right answer. And you and I both agreed, let's go with the fun answer. The drunk driver driving over the H. It's a lot more fun. And since I can't figure out which one's which, then I went with the one that is the most fun. Now, I did end up cutting it out of the novel because it really didn't fit. But I think sometimes that's what you have to do.
Yeah, but you see, you couldn't change the Hollywood sign because that was part of your whole plot revolved around that. Whereas I can change the train line to somewhere else because it's not integral to the plot. And that's why when I say, if I can't get it to work, I change it. I've just done writing this third Clyde Smith book, I just had to change a whole lot of things because I thought this, although I want this to work, it doesn't, because this particular item was not in the shape until about 3 years after the period. I thought, no one will know, but I'll know. So I changed the object. But see, you couldn't have with the Hollywood sign. You couldn't go, it doesn't matter about the, whether it's been run over, rotted, or fall down, because it still has to be the Hollywood sign, doesn't it? It can't be another sign, because your book wouldn't have worked.
Yes, and I know exactly what letters fell down at different parts throughout its history and had to be propped up and that sort of thing. It just, that H was the one in question as to how it actually fell down. And I liked the drunk story.
Yeah. Oh, that's a great story.
It's a lot more fun than it just falling down.
Yeah.
I did notice that food was a very large part of this novel, that it, much larger than it was in the past novel.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that's because Clyde uses food preparation and eating as a social activity to drive forward conversation and plot. Because you know what it's like when you're sitting down, you have dinner with your table, with your family, you start to talk about things that aren't about, you know, like I went shopping today, you start to talk about real issues. And sometimes he uses that to drive his interrogations or his thought processes or to tweak out feedback from his friends while they're preparing food and eating. And it's also a big social thing among continental or Mediterranean people, that social activity over preparing and eating food. It used to be mum cooking, preparing all the food in the kitchen by herself, and dad sitting in the reading the paper and having a smoke while the kids played with toys, and then mum brings the food in and serves it. But, you know, Mediterraneans don't do that. It's everybody in together. And I wanted to bring that in. It helps drive the narrative as well in many parts, that preparing food and eating and discussing cases while they're eating.
Are you ready for awkward questions authors get?
Yep, sure.
All right. So, hold on. You may have been one of the authors that gave me some of these odd questions. Maybe you'll get the one that you gave me.
Oh, my God. I hope not.
I don't know. We'll see. Hold on, and we'll spin the wheel. Okay, I think I've got a good one for you. Why are queer books necessary?
Well, that's like saying why are books about women necessary, or why books about children are necessary. I mean, most queer people don't define themselves by their queerness. It's just who they are. They're human beings, and they have their love interests lie with people of the same sex. It doesn't define who they are. People don't go, I'm a queer person. They go, hey, I'm a man or I'm a woman, and my partner, my love interest, my fascination is for people of the other sex. I think that we just need to, I mean, if you'd asked 50 years ago, let's say in the United States, why are books about black people necessary? I'm sure you'd have got an answer that went, well, they're not really. But things have changed, and I think we're just part of normal society. I think that my particular type of queer books are about, really about people who are just gay. It's not who that what defines them, or they don't revolve around gay communities. It's just like the normal builders and labourers and policemen and postmen and guys who dig the streets who just happen to have a male partner rather than a female. They don't see themselves as anything particularly different.
Yeah, I find it interesting. I had people say, well, why don't you write more mainstream novels? Maybe you'd make more money if you wrote mainstream novels. And my response has been, you know, over the years, I've loved mysteries. I've loved Sue Grafton. I loved Lawrence Block. I've loved Robert B. Parker. They were wonderful novels. But to find mysteries that where the protagonists were like me, and they don't understand that.
Yeah.
It's really surprising.
It's sort of like saying that there are no gay detectives in the whole wide world and there are no gay policemen in the whole wide world, but there are, and they have their lives and their stories, and their lives and their stories are just as interesting as their heterosexual counterparts. So why not?
I'm with you there.
I think we start to – the more we normalize, we've never had – the same level of division that you have in the United States with with race. But the more that we normalize that sort of thing, the less impactful it will be in society in general. Let's go that if I see a coloured person in the street, I go, oh, wow, there's a coloured person, or I need to keep away from that person. I need to do anything. I just go, there's a person. So the same with writing books. When we read books about, I have had a couple of people write to me and say, have you ever thought about writing straight books? And I write back, I said, no, well, there's 50 gazillion writers who write books about straight people, and there's a whole history of thousands of years of written about straight people that, you know, you can refer to. Why not read something about who people from my culture, my group, my subgroup or whatever come from?
Good for you. That is a good answer.
Okay. A long answer, but hopefully.
No, it was a good answer. I liked it. So I hate to close it out, but my guest is Garrick Jones, and his most recent novel is The Gilded Madonna, which is the second in the Clyde Smith mystery. When can we expect number three?
Probably this time next year. I'm just about finished writing it now. I've probably got about 20,000 words to go, and then it will probably need to sit for a few months before I go back and revisit it, and then the editing process will probably out. I'll probably, you know, April, May next year. Probably.
What can we expect next?
The next book out is X for Extortion, which is the sequel to The 7th of December, which is the second book in my World War II series. And then in January, I have a Victorian-era spy novel.
Oh.
Set in 1955 at the end of the Crimean War in London, and that will be out then. That's another adventure, mystery, adventure story.
Well, that sounds interesting.
There's no murder in it, but it is a crime book, basically.
There doesn't always have to be a body.
No. Sometimes it's more interesting when you can't find one, isn't it? And you think there is one.
Well, Garrick, it's always a pleasure to have you on. Thank you for being on.
Thank you, Brad. I've enjoyed myself immensely.
Be sure to subscribe to Queer Writers of Crime wherever you hear our show. Tell a friend too. Thank you for listening.